We're at the Western Mass Young Association tonight. And there, how many people are on the email list? If you're not on the email list and you would like to get our emails, we only get through a month. There's an email list over there, so please put your name down on the email list. I want to thank my board. Dan is our webmaster, and Chris is our camera woman, and Carol is our community person, and Judy, who is not here right now, is our editor and secretary. We have 8 people on our board, which to me shows the kind of interest that is growing in this organization. And Peter is our setup person and everything else, and he started the organization. Historian. Thank you. We really appreciate your donations. That's what we can run the website with, and how we bring in people like Russell tonight. So if you haven't donated, please donate on the way out. And Chris is going to say a little thing about the books, because I'm confused.
We have books. We have books. Some of you who've been coming know we acquired a collection of books, and they're available for $2 or $4. So please look at the books. They're a different selection every time. A lot of really fine authors. So it's a great deal.
And our next presentation will be John Yule, and it will be in the Hillier Hall, which is in the Arts Building, Fine Arts Building. And he's talking on Healing the 21st Century, and we have a flyer put up. So if you're in a school or a college, or you know where to put one up in the hill towns, which we don't get up to, please grab a few flyers and help us put them around, because people really get our information from there. Also, we have a wonderful new brochure from the Boston Young Association, or Young, their public program. So we have some on the table if you're interested in some. How many people saw David Shane last year on alcohol? He's going to be teaching there this year. So if you didn't get to see him and you missed it, he's going to be in Boston, the first weekend in April. Okay, let's see. We don't take breaks tonight, so some of you know the routine. There is a bathroom right here that says men, but don't worry about that. So just feel free to take care of your own needs and come back in. And we're also recording. We're starting to video record our programs, and they actually go on our archives in the website. So we have permission to video. And if you ask a question, be aware that we're recording. And if you don't want it to be recorded, just say, please turn off the recording, and we'd be happy to accommodate you. And afterwards, we'd like to meet at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street for further conversation and tea and community building, and it's really wonderful, so feel free to come to the Mosaic Cafe. So, let's see. And Penelope Tarasuk, one of our local analysts, we hope is going to be doing a dream workshop towards the end of April, hopefully the 23rd or the 30th. We hope. We haven't heard back from Smith, but we hope it's going to be the 23rd, and there'll be a donation of $40 that'll be in this building in one of the classrooms. So she might say a few words about that. We aren't totally clear about the date, but you'll get it on our email list or our website, or it'll be announced. Okay, so tonight we have Michelangelo, the three Pietas, with Russell Holmes, and Penelope Tarasuk's going to tell us about Russell.
Good evening. I don't really know a lot about your history, Russell, but I believe you began as a Carmelite monk approximately 1960. Is that right? I don't know what got you interested in Jung, but you studied at the Zurich Institute, and I believe you said you finished in 70... Did you finish in 74?
I started in 74. I finished in 79.
finished in 79, and then I guess the monastery brought you to Boston.
Right.
Right, okay. And that's when I started training, was in 1979. So that's when I met Russell. And I'm very fond of Russell. And he has marvelous humor and great feeling function. I'll tell you one little story. When I was in training in, I think it might have been the first or second year, he invited the class of students, there were probably, I don't know, six of us at that time, to the monastery. And he taught fairy tales in this marvelous monastic room. And he wasn't in his robes, he took his robes off, they were hanging up in the bathroom. But I will never forget, at the end of the class, him serving tea in Carmelitengeist. And it was very Jungian. It was delightful. And I think of you, Russell, with great delight. My former husband was in analysis with Russell, and my older son used to sometimes go. And I think you gave him Cokes and he could watch TV. So he's very interested in analysis. Let's see, what else? Oh, I want to say there is this special place in Russell, and I can't even describe why it happens, but I remember in a dream that I had about him that I was at a place called World's End, and there is a place like that, but it was a place that was so beautiful, and I found a telephone booth, and I called Russell. And said, Russell, I'm really here. So there's this place of great spirit and beauty in Russell. So I'm very happy to hear you tonight.
Thank you.
A little mood music. I'm going to be talking about Michelangelo tonight, the three pietas, and my interest in this came out of a presentation I gave on music, and I was talking about archetypal themes in music, and one of them was death. So I needed, and I was using the Fauré Requiem, and you know the Fauré Requiem is very lovely and beautiful and sweet. Kind and everything. But at the end of the Requiem, there's the song called the Liber Me. It gets pretty violent and pretty powerful. The dies irae, it's sort of like a weeping and gnashing of teeth, the falling into the jaws of the lion and so on. So I needed two images, one sweet image to go with the soft Fauré, and one a little more powerful to go with the violent Fauré. So I chose this and this. And that's how I got interested in these two pietas. And then I realized by looking through art books that there was a third pieta. And that I would like, then I got really interested in that, and that's how I got involved in this material I'm going to present to you. This pieta, Michelangelo finished when he was 23 years old.
Oh.
It was made for a cardinal, a French cardinal, whose name was Bonheur, for his tomb in Rome, in the Church of Santa Sabina in Rome. Unfortunately, Cardinal Bellur died before it was finished. So this was placed in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and it's not the basilica that's there now. It was an earlier basilica, and because it was so beautiful, it attracted a number of people. And you may have heard the story that one night Michelangelo went to check it out, see if anybody was interested, and there was a crowd in there talking about it, and they were saying, well, who did this? You know, who did this? And they were naming who might have done it. So he realized that he was being shortchanged. So that night, when it was closed, he came back and chiseled right across Mary's breast, Michelangelo haec fecit. Michelangelo made this. See? So that's the only, as far as I know, that's the only piece of work that he has signed. See? This pietà he did when he was 80. He began this when he was 80 years old. And this one, he hadn't finished this, and there's a lot of story that goes with it. And then he started this, and he was working on both of these at the same time. Now this one, he worked on until he was 89 years old. And he was working on this until 3 days before he died. So you can see there's an incredible psychic progression here in the life of Michelangelo. And hopefully I can give you some information about it. This here is real Renaissance. This screams Renaissance. It's beautiful bodies, two gorgeous bodies, and there's one thing that one dimension that I want to point out to you that you probably haven't noticed is the fabric. There's a lot of fabric there. There's yards and yards and yards of fabric, okay? And that's very important. But this is Renaissance, and I wanted to say a few words about the Renaissance that I'm sure you already know, but just for my own security, I need to tell you this. The Renaissance, 14th to 17th century, was the bridge between the Middle Ages and modern history. It began as a cultural movement in Italy, but its intellectual base was humanism. That is, man is the center of all things. Possibly the great manifesto of the Renaissance was a book by Giovanni Pico called On the Dignity of Man. And in a sense, in general, though not terribly strictly, it was moving from bodily shame and concealment from the Gothic period to the medieval period to a more open expression of humanity and especially of bodily presence. It was also the period where the Latin language, the vernacular language, began to be used as opposed to Greek. It was marked by a nostalgia for ancient Greek and Roman artifacts. And when we talk about ancient Greek and Roman artifacts, we're really talking about Greek artifacts, because the Romans were crazy about Greek stuff, especially sculptures, and most of their important pieces had been taken from Greece, copied, borrowed, or stolen. So basically, what we're talking about is Greek rebirth of what was something that began in Greek. In artworks, it was marked by the development of perspective in painting, which was very new. The idea of pietà, the pity, began in Christian iconography probably 100 years earlier in 1350, and it was connected to the plague and to wars. And the Christians of that time sort of tied into the God of suffering. Jesus, who suffered death, was a great consolation to them. They could identify that with that, and it gave them great consolation. Interestingly enough, the image of the Pietà in modern times certainly was a very important image in Catholicism in the 1930s and 40s because of the wars, the First World War and the Second World War. And many, most Catholic churches in the United States had images of the Pietà statues in the church. These weren't Michelangelo's. These were like chalkware. These were plaster of Paris Catholic kinds of statues. But it was very, very important. And it wasn't unusual if you went to Mass on Sunday to see mothers who had sons in the army or who had sons or daughters who were killed in the army kneeling before these images of the Pietà and lighting candles. I remember that very distinctly when I was a little boy. So it's an image that, it's really an archetypal image. It's an archetypal image of lamentation. It's grieving. It's grieving the death of your, in this image here, the Pietà, it's the worst grief you could have. It's the grief of the mother whose son died. See, there's no worse kind of suffering in history. So it's and it's also grieving for anything that we have, any loss that we have. It's losing a job. It's losing a partner. It's losing money. It's losing whatever you might lose. This is an image of lamentation, of mourning, of grieving. You know, it's terrible, terrible grieving. See? So that that's a little background I wanted to give you from the Renaissance. This period was also included other very important events. For example, the discovery of the Americas by Christopher Columbus, Galileo, Copernicus, Martin Luther. So the whole world was in a great turmoil, a great discovery, an opening up, and a kind of rebirth. Now, Michelangelo, I want to tie you into Michelangelo and the Renaissance. I'm not going to, as we go along, I will talk more and more about his history. But just to tie him into the Renaissance, he was a very smart kid, a very gifted kid. Some people say that his father did not approve of his being an artist. He liked to sketch and draw. I don't know if we could prove that. But whatever the father did a very proper thing in that he got his gifted child into an apprenticeship at an art studio in Florence, because Florence was the center of the Renaissance, with two brothers, Domenico and Davido Ghirlandaio, and they had like a middle school and up for young gifted children, boys of course, where they taught them painting, sketching, sculpting, and so on. And Mr. Buonarroti got Michelangelo into that group as a paid apprentice for a 3-year term. After a year, Ghirlandaio somehow saw the extraordinary gift of Michelangelo and got him into the same kind of setup with the Medici family, who had a garden, an art garden, where they had sculptures and classes and all kinds of creative things for very gifted children. It would be like an arts high school in our day. And again, Michelangelo was accepted, excelled, and was a paid apprentice. Now, the wonderful thing about this, like if you were one of these gifted children, or if you had a son or a daughter in these days,
that was that gifted, they couldn't have been in a better place. Hmm? The Medicis were, you know, a very wealthy family, very powerful, had a huge shadow, but they were very interested in everything, especially the arts. Cosimo Medici, the grandfather of the ruling Medicis at this time, set up a Platonic Academy to study Neoplatonism. And he brought in all kinds of very gifted intellectuals and philosophers to come and teach at this academy. And it was so powerful that in Florence, on Plato's birthday, which was November 7th, was a national holiday. So that's the ilk of this organization. But there were politicians, there were bankers, there were weavers, there were all the very highest level of any kind of human endeavor would be invited and present at the Medici table. And the custom was that whoever, and of course Michelangelo lived there, he had a room in the house. The custom was that the first person in the dining room would sit with Lorenzo. And Lorenzo was called Lorenzo the Magnificent. And he was certainly truly a magnificent person, very gifted, very creative, and very generous. And of course, Michelangelo was not a shy kid, so you can be sure that he had his whack at Lorenzo and any of the other very powerful people that came to dine at the Medici family. See, it was just a wonderful opportunity for somebody like that. And Michelangelo was worthy of it. He was a very gifted, incredibly gifted child. He had four brothers, and as far as I can determine, the others did not have those gifts. They were quite ordinary. And his father was a very quite ordinary person. He was sort of a public servant. He had small jobs around town, so to speak. And as is the custom for most European families, they say, well, at one time they had a lot of money, but they lost it. So, you know, we were very, very powerful at one time, but anyway, that gives you some background on how Michelangelo got sort of merged into the Renaissance, you know, and he would have been one of the if not the one of the most important carriers of Renaissance art and sculpture. At the same time in Florence, this is in Florence, there was also Leonardo da Vinci and Botticelli. So you had this incredible explosion of creative talent that was present at that time. It was a very, very exciting time. The thing I want to mention particularly around his presence, his experience at the Medici Gardens, was his exposure to a philosopher. The philosopher's name is Marsilio Ficino. Jung makes many references to him. There's a whole page of references to Marsilio Ficino and Jung's index. James Hillman was nuts about Marsilio Ficino, and James Hillman sort of based his archetypal psychology on Ficino's philosophy, Neoplatonism, the Platonic. So Michelangelo would have had dinner with him, and Ficino was sort of a funny little man. He was sort of deformed. He was a hunchback, and he had a speech impediment. He was a priest, and he was the son of Cosimo Medici's medical doctor, and the Medici a lot, you know, he was brought into this setting, but he also had a farm. They gave him a farm, and he could go and do farming, where he could also work on his philosophy. Jung was really excited about him because Pacino translated the early alchemical texts, the Hermes Trismegistus. He translated that, and Jung used that translation, see, and preferred it to any other translations of alchemical texts, see. So that was part of the stage that Michelangelo was exposed to. Now let me just read you a little bit. I hate to read to people, but I'm going to read to you. Michelangelo could have been exposed to the philosophy, to this philosophy, that's Pacino's, at the table of Lorenzo de' Medici. Cosimo de' Medici had established an academy of Platonic philosophy. As I said earlier, the family had the live-in philosopher Marsilio Pacino. He wrote a famous treatise on the immortality of the soul. Pacino was also a literary scholar, translated the Bible into Latin, which had not been done. He also translated the Corpus Hermeticum of Hermes Trismegistus into Latin. He was also an alchemist himself. These were the days of alchemy. A quote from Pacino from the Corpus Hermeticum. Seeing within myself an immaterial vision that came from the mercy of God, I went out of myself into an immortal body. And now I am not what I was before. I have been born in mind. That's Plato. Hmm? The Platonic path appealed to Michelangelo aesthetically and ideologically. It was Pacino's teaching that beauty was the way to God. The soul was consumed by the divine brilliance, which shines in beauteous man as though in a mirror, is seized by the brilliance as is drawn upward as by a hook. Whether of a man or a woman, the body's beauty is just the shadow of the soul, which is more important than the body. Ideas are more important than things. See? And of course, that's the whole thing with Michelangelo's work. They were beautiful. See, this is really beautiful. This may not move you because of the posture or whatever the expression is on the faces, but it is, you can't deny, it is very beautiful. And Michelangelo, in his depictions of the sufferings of Christ, you'll notice there's just a tiny mark here of the wounds in Christ's feet. See, there's no blood, there's no gaping holes. It's even in its pain, he maintains the beauty of it. And that he got that from from Pacino. That certainly was the origin of Michelangelo's attraction to beauty. Even though it may have been there before that, it was affirmed by Pacino's philosophy. To continue with Pacino, to attain true happiness, man must make the ascent by intellect and will, through knowledge and love, from the maternal of the elements to the immaternal heaven, to soul without dimension, to the angel world without change, to God's substance without attribute, to become partakers of the divine. The quality and severity and gravitas of the Pietà and the sculpture was balanced by Michelangelo's heavy weight, intellect, and poetic interest in works. He was recognized as an expert in Dante and was a devotee of St. Francis. If we were to study Michelangelo in the context of the archetype of the puer aeternus, which we're not, we could access Henry Corbin's statement. The puer is and carries for us the vision of our own first true nature. our primordial golden shadow, our affinity to inner and outer beauty. Our angelic essence is the messenger of the divine. And that's certainly what Michelangelo represented. That's what he did. To take it a little further in terms of Neoplatonism and accessing the Greek thought on the notion of theory, theoria, which the Greeks understood to be contemplation. Theoria is the theoria, the Greek word, is the root for theory, and also theater. And what it represents is and means is looking at something, observing, seeing a spectacle, watching something. For example, in the Greek tragedies, watching the performance of the Greek tragedies. Everything is contemplation, observed with the eyes of the soul, disambiguated. And for Plato, that was the contemplation of the forms. For Jungians, the contemplation of the archetypes, the archetypal roots of our experience. The highest contemplation was the vision of God, ascent to the highest good, and so on. So that, in a sense, is I think was very important to for Michelangelo, and it's also very important for us to observe what he produced, to observe his works. So that's just a little introduction. Okay. And that, I wanted to say that about the Renaissance. Now, these are examples, this is stepping backwards slightly, these are examples of Greek sculptures from, let's say, the 3rd century BC. This here is the Belvedere trunk. It's in the Vatican. It's a fragment. This is the Venus de Milo, and that's Nike. That's in the Louvre. And these were, I think that is a copy. But this was, I referred earlier to a rebirth of Greek culture and sculpture. And these would be examples of the originals that we are trying to recover, to return to. So now I want to talk about this. This Pietà. This is the Roman Pietà done when he was 23, and I want to talk about it in the context of lamentation, which I mentioned earlier. I'm going to make a Greek reference here again. In the categories of the dynamics of Greek tragedy, which seems to fit perfectly with my purpose here. The categories of the Greek tragedy were agon, the struggle between the protagonist and the power of evil, pathos, the passion of the hero's defeat, thranos, the lamentation for the defeated hero, and theophany, the rebirth of life on another level with the reversal of sorrow to joy. The spectacle of the Greek tragic drama offered observers an opportunity to participate in the contemplation of divine realities, namely the interplay of life and death, the life, death, and rebirth of the hero. The play gives honor to the gods, and by emotional participation, a catharsis to those who watch it. the contemplation of human suffering is it, as enacted by the actors in the chorus, had the effect of edifying and transforming the spectators with a cathartic light of beauty. That's what may be happening here if you look upon this in your lament. The beauty changes the experience. It's not just that my son died. It's not just that my lover left me. But I have this beauty, I'm pulled into this beauty, and it allows me some kind of catharsis. I'll give you an example. Like, if you have you seen the movie Schindler's List?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember your feelings when the John Williams music starts up? And there are certain poignant details in the film where that music swells and it pulls you up, and you feel this feeling, this catharsis, see? Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to Fenway Park? When the basses are loaded, the organ playing, see? Or the seventh inning wave, see? That's theater. That's theater. If you go to church, if you go to Mass on Sunday and the choir is really good, or if the organist plays a Bach chorale, there's a cathartic moment in the beauty of the experience, which takes you out of your pain, maybe just momentarily. See, but we have these liturgies, these rituals, which really, I don't think they started, but we can refer very easily to the Greek tragic dramas, which for their purpose was to provide a catharsis for our own pain. See. It is art imitating life, as Aristotle says, depicting human action and consequences for tragedy. Fear and pity are necessary. It must involve somebody like ourselves enduring an undeserved struggle with which the ordinary person can identify. I can see myself there, see? I can see myself weeping, when I see somebody, a child suffering, must involve somebody like ourselves. I can see myself there. The hero removes himself or is removed from his own narcissistic space. And in the Christian, with Michelangelo, the mystery he was depicting was that of Christ. And here we have a scriptural reference that sort of defines that. Though he was in the form of God, he did not deem equality with God something to be grasped at. Rather, he emptied himself and took the form of a slave, being born in the likeness of men. He was known to have been of human estate, and it was thus that he humbled himself to death on the cross. So, like, Jesus becoming man was like the taking off his identification with God. See, and that's what we do when we move beyond our own narcissism. See. And that's what we're witnessing here. Nietzsche talks about this in The Birth of Tragedy. Nietzsche's sense was that the birth of tragedy in Greek cultural history was an extraordinary revelation of the fundamental, universal, and enduring reality of human existence, what it means to be alive. He invokes the gods Apollo and Dionysus to express the play of opposites in Greek tragedy. Apollo represents the fixed, rational, clear, ordered, and intelligent state of the human event. Dionysus, however, represents the never fixed, always mobile, and is always mobile in the endless motion of music. In the unbreakable tension between the two, there is beauty, blending dark and light. Michelangelo expresses this in the tension between the fixed marble sculpture and the claw. See, this is the Dionysian. See, it's the wrinkles. It's the spontaneous. See, look at that claw on the breasts of the Virgin. See? But it's also like in the original Greek representation, that was done with music, combining the act and then accompanied by the music. And I'm gonna do that for you right now. I'm going to do this twice. The first is sort of some slides, a tableau of sort of formal images with music. And then the second one is going to be more contemporary slides with more contemporary music. And what I'm trying to do is I want to put this, the Apollonian and the Dionysian together and see what it feels like. The more formal. This will be more contemporary. Did you feel the good? That was chapter one. This is chapter two. One of the obvious things about the Pietà is it's basically a mother and her son, a mother and child. And I want to explore that topic in Michelangelo's life, because I think it's very important. We all have mother complexes. The mother complex is very, very powerful and very important. And it's particularly important for creative people. The mother is the matrix. All life comes from some kind of a mother. And Michelangelo's mother died when he was six. He was sent to be nursed as an infant
and he was returned to his family when he was 2 years old. And when he was six, his mother died. So he was with his mother just 4 years. His father remarried within 4 years, and then he had a stepmother, and she died when he was 22. It's said that he missed the mother, or that there was some kind of a loss or lack of the mother. He doesn't say that, but people who study his life say he did. And therefore, I want to talk about his mother and show you some examples of how the mother-child image comes across in his works. This is a piece. It's called The Madonna of the Stairs. He was probably 13 or 14 years old when he did that. Take a close look at the mother and her posture toward the child. This is a painting he did. It's called the Doni Tondo. And it was a commission that a young man gave him to paint this picture for his bride. This man was getting married, and he wanted to give this to his bride. And that's another one. But take a close look at the connection, the relation, the posture of the mother and the child. This is a Madonna he did for the Medici tomb in San Lorenzo in Florence. Take a close look at the connection between the mother and the child. This is an image, it's a Pietà, that he did for a friend of his, a woman friend, one of his most important relationships. Her name was Colonna, Vittoria Colonna. She was an aristocratic woman from Naples who was a widow. And she was an artist, and they used to exchange poetry and art. And this is a piece that he did for her. He did it reluctantly. She liked angels. See the two angels? He didn't like angels, but he did. But notice certainly there's a birth image here of the body of the child coming out from her, between her legs. But notice the posture of the mother there. See? Here's another important image of the mother. Now this is the creation of Adam. It's a pivotal painting for Michelangelo. Notice, see the lady up there? That in the book of Proverbs, that's wisdom. Sometimes it can be interpreted as Mary and Jesus. See, this is the baby. That's the mother. In the book of Proverbs, you may have heard this referred to before, it said when God created the world, wisdom was with him. So this would be Sophia. Hagia Sophia, this is would be wisdom. And she was with him. Then I was at his side each day, his darling and delight, playing in his presence continually, playing on the earth when he finished it, while my delight was in mankind. So that's wisdom right there. And now this is her baby. Notice, she's got her hand on the father's arm, not on her baby. And the baby's holding on here for dear life so he doesn't fall off. Notice that? And notice her breasts. These don't look like milking and nursing breasts. See? Would nursing breasts be fuller? Yeah. See? So that's another image of mother and child. Okay. Now I'm going to stick here
and hopefully make it a comment here. When the mother, when our personal mothers have weaknesses or deficiencies, the psyche will push you deeper to the archetypal mother, to something, something that's that will stabilize your personality. There is an archetypal pillar, maternal pillar, that wants the child to live and to survive. And that, even if you're an old man, that happens. There's something in the psyche that is maternal, that gives life, that nurtures life. See? So, in with Michelangelo, on this painting, I think it was wisdom. I think wisdom, Sophia, sort of moved in and did the mothering for him, psychically. See? Because, and here's another image of it. This is in the Sistine Chapel. This is the Sibyl of Cuma. And she's 900 years old. Apollo told her she could live forever, but she would have to keep the same body. So she's not going to get, she's going to just get older and older, looking older and older and older. But he in the Sistine Chapel ceiling, he juxtaposes these women prophetesses with the prophets of the Old Testament. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, and who's the other one? Daniel. So for each of those Old Testament prophets, he attaches a pre-Judeo prophecy, what he would have called a pagan prophetess, and that's one of them. And I think that also suggests he had this incredible deep connection to the eternal feminine, the primal eternal feminine. And I'm going to read this here from Jung, that sort of supports this. The anima of a man has a strongly historical character. As a personification of the unconscious, she goes back into prehistory and embodies the contents of the past. She provides the individual with those elements that he ought to know about in his prehistory. To the individual, the anima is all life that has been in the past and is still alive in him. So I think this is a pretty good example of how in this artistic person of Michelangelo, he had this incredible depth. The conscious mother, the conscious feminine, somehow was absent. And so he fell into this deeper place, and of course that would be where real wisdom is, and that would be, it would be the source of his talent. See, that would be a very, very creative, you know, a very dynamic, creative, deep place. But and here's another, here's the other one. She is absolutely beautiful. This is not a good reproduction. This is the Libyan Sibyl. See, this is another prophet. See, but she's absolutely, isn't she a gorgeous person? Look at the clothes on her. See, now we're going to go back here. Notice in this, if you haven't seen it already, up on the top, see those little figures up there? They're stretching fabric. See those little boys? They're stretching fabric. They're holding fabric. And here, see, these are adolescent boys now. See, they're stretching fabric. See? Now the Medicis supported fabric and textiles. They both they wove them and they dyed them. Other fabric producers would send fabric to Florence to have it dye because they have the secret of colors. But so you've got those two. Now that would be a historical connection to the fabric, but also here. See the fabric here. See, in the Sistine Chapel on the ceiling, these are ignudi, and periodically throughout the whole ceiling, you have these young men who are holding on to fabric. See, and fabric is mother. Fabric is from the mother. So in a sense, he's got this deep connection to the archetypal feminine, to the creative feminine, the matrix. But he's still playing with the personal mother in the fabric. Here, I'll read you a thing. This is from Louisa von Franz. There you have the motif of the claw and the many threads in it. I must confess I do not know what this refers to in plain words. I think one can only say that the mystery of giving birth is basically associated with the idea of spinning and weaving and complicated feminine activities consisting in bringing together natural elements in a certain order. The biological analogy which imposes itself upon one's mind is that every child is coming together in a definite pattern of inherited units. We know that every human being is a complex factor. We could call it a woven cloth of all the ancestral units, both biological and psychological, which make a single thing. So that producing a child is like weaving it together from all the different elements, chemical, biological, and psychological. And so it looks like in his works, he's still working on his own giving birth to himself. You see, the cloth is still there. And you'll see that, and that's why in the first image I showed you of the Roman Pietà, of the cloth, of the fabric. See, this yards and yards of fabric. Now, this is Rembrandt. I couldn't resist this, because here you have, in death, see, this is Jesus being taken off the cross, and see the cloth, see the white cloth that he's also returning into, becoming the cloth, see? And notice, the cloth color is the same as the mother, see?
See?
Because in death we go back, like we have, you have your swaddling clothes and you have your shroud. See, in both places we refer to some kind of material, some kind of fabric, some kind of texture. See, I couldn't resist putting that in. Now, as opposed to Da Vinci, you can see. Oh, wonderful. Yeah. See the difference in Leonardo da Vinci's mother. See, the child, she's looking right at him, there's no question. And he's even got St. Anne, the dual mother. The second, there are two mothers there, flooding this child with love. See? And here's another one of Da Vinci. See the difference? Can you feel the difference? You know, in Michelangelo's Madonnas, none of them are looking at the child, and in the Doni Tondo, the child is neither with Mary or Joseph. It's like she's saying. Let me see. We'll go back. Who wants it? Do you want it? No, you take it. See, and she's got a book. See, she's been reading. She's studying. She's in Jungian training.
Now, this is another interesting thing about mothers. Speaking of mothers, there were three men who were very supportive of Michelangelo. The Garlandale brothers, Lorenzo the Magnificent, and Julius II, the Pope. And there is such a thing, you may know this in your analysis or your own experience, there's such a thing as a paternal, a paternal nourishment that a man can give love and nurturance in the manner of a mother. And I think these three men, all of whom were part of his life, were like mother figures to him, sifted through their very powerful masculinity. Now this here, this is Moses. You recognize Moses. This is Pope Julius's tomb. It's in St. Peter in Chains in Rome. And when you go there, you can stand right here. You can touch it. It's 8 feet tall. When Julius got Michelangelo to come to Rome from Florence, and there was always a lot of fighting between Rome and Florence, you know your history. He brought him there to make his tomb. Julius was the beginning of his papacy. He was already planning his tomb to be a freestanding monument in St. Peter's Basilica. The original plan had 47 life-size figures in it. Michelangelo worked on it for 40 years. It's sort of like a dissertation that you never finish. And every time he got started, Julius would say, well, I want you to do this. For example, could you do the Sistine ceiling? Can you do it? And then there were seven popes that kept doing this. And Michelangelo had been given a down payment to do it. So it sort of shrunk. And but in the final stage, this was the center of it, and I didn't have the slide of the whole thing. It would have been more important. But in the full monument, this is central. And here is a statue of Rachel, who was Jacob's wife. And over here is Leah, who was another wife of Jacob. Two mothers, huh? Leah had some children. Rachel was barren, but miraculously had Joseph, who was the Technicolor cult guy, and Benjamin. But here he puts Moses. This is the monument to Julius, his patron. See, he puts him between two mothers. See, and the other thing. This is something that it's not my insight. Somebody else pointed this out to me, another historian, is that this posture of the arm and his hand on the stomach is the posture you would hold a child with. See? And it's not very a man does not put his hand on his stomach. This is like a womb. We don't touch it usually. Men, we're up here. But there you have and it fits. That would be where a child would be held, see? And for all the baloney that Julius made, all the hoops that he made Michelangelo jump through, Michelangelo must have truly appreciated him as somebody who held him. It held him in his interest, see? And of course, here this is the law, see, but this is sort of insignificant over here. The center of the painting is right here. This isn't, it's right here.
his horns? Can you comment on the horns on his head?
Oh, yeah. That's a mistake. The horns, it comes from a mistake in translating a word. When they translated the Septuagint from Greek to Latin, the word for horn is similar to the word for rays, light rays, and it should be light rays. See, mm-hmm. See, and that's why they have the horns. Okay, one more on the fathering, the paternal mothering. Notice here, we've already spoken. See the wisdom there is not paying attention to her baby. He's going to fall off. But God, the Father's hand is on the baby. See? He's touching her. She is. See? Okay. That's chapter 2. This is chapter 3.
Turn the lights back on.
You need them?
No.
No, yeah,
you do.
No, I don't.
I
no.
Do.
You do?
Yeah. Now, what I want to do here is now, I've given you my projections about Michelangelo and his psychology. This could be all about me, you know. This is a projective project. But those are my projections about the mother and and so on. Now, I want to point out a couple of things that Michelangelo says about himself. Here, this is, now he's 80 years old doing this. His life has changed. And here we have, we humans get really excited when we have a quaternity, you know, because it's wholeness, see? And here you have a quaternity. You have Mary and Jesus, you've got Joseph of Arimathea, and you've got Mary Magdalene, see? And I wonder, Joseph of Arimathea is sort of paired up in Christian theology with Nicodemus. And Nicodemus was somebody who showed an interest in Jesus, but didn't make any commitment. He was the one that went at night and said, what do you mean we have to be reborn? Does that mean we have to go back into our mother's womb? Now, Jung quotes this, see? And Jesus said, no, you should be born in the spirit. And Jung uses that to talk about rebirth and individuation. But Nicodemus wasn't committed to Jesus, see? So here Michelangelo is 80 years old. He's been working his butt off for the Pope and the Catholic Church and everything, and now his God is dead. And I wonder if Nicodemus doesn't represent Michelangelo pulling back from his faith somewhat. He's holding up the burden of his faith, see? Something which is part of our faith experience, you know? You know, you lose the enthusiasm of the Roman Pietà. He was 23 years old. When you're 23, you believe, it's easy to believe. When you're 80, it's not so easy, see? Then we have Mary Magdalene, and here, what I'd like to point out, here is your eternal feminine again, see? Like we talked about the prophetesses and so on. And I want to just go back. See this hand here? See that around her? See his hand around her? Mm-hmm. He repeats things. He repeats postures.
here's Michelangelo as a young man. There he is as an older man. Notice he has a broken nose, because when he was at the Ghirlandaio brothers, he had a fight with another student, because Michelangelo used to make fun of the other student's work because it was so inferior. And this other, his classmate, hit him in the nose, knocked him down, broke his nose, and he told him, "Now you will never ever get rid of the impact I made on your face. You may be a great artist and be known for your art, but you'll never ever they will see my mark on your nose." Now, we talked about Nicodemus and maybe suggesting that Michelangelo's faith was thin. Now, here's another image of Michelangelo. He may be telling us something about himself. That's his face. See? Now, this is in the Last Judgment. And this is St. Bartholomew. He was an apostle who was flayed because he was a Christian and he was crucified and so on. But Michelangelo chose to represent himself as the flayed skin of Bartholomew. And he now, you know, there was a myth of Marsyas, who he was a satyr who was a musician, and he challenged Apollo to a contest about who would be the better musician. And the winner could do anything he wanted to the loser. And so Apollo won, of course, and he decided to flay Marsyas. And so certainly Michelangelo would be aware of that myth. But here's what Michelangelo himself says about it. This is Jung. This is from a Jungian work. "Playing symbolizes a transformation process which on the one hand lays bare the inner man and on the other hand signifies the extraction of the soul. A sonnet of Michelangelo's refers to the theme of flame." This is the sonnet. "To others merciful and only to itself unkind, this lowly creature who sloughs off its skin in pain that it may give pleasure to others dies that they may live. So do I long for such a destiny that from my death, my Lord, you might alone take life. Then by my death I too might be changed like the worm which casts its skin on stone. For if that skin were mine, I could at least be woven in a gown to clasp that breast and so embrace the beauty that I crave." So that's how he thought. It also evokes the image of the skin, the snake who sheds his skin. It's like a resurrection, it's like a renewal kind of thing, see? But very, very painful. Now, I don't want to make you too sad, but this is Titian, and this is an image of Marsyas, and I put this up here. I saw a show with Sister Wendy. Remember Sister Wendy and her aunt? She had a wonderful comment on this, and she said she thought it was Titian's. This is Titian here. Wondering about his artistic creative gift, and because he said all artists suffer this kind of flame, because you challenge the gods. A creative person challenges the god. I dare to do something that you usually do. See, and I want to do it better.
and she suggests, she's very good, she says, and Titian is saying, did I go far enough? Did I push the gods far enough? See? And then she adds that here you have the young artist who's got a nice dog there, very enthusiastic. And here you have an artist, a younger artist, who doesn't even see the pain of what it is to be an artist. He's playing his fiddle, see? You've got the god that you've exposed, that you're exposed to, and you pay for it. And then you've got, see the common man up there? The butcher. He's working on you too, because he doesn't like what you do. See? He doesn't appreciate the beauty. And then you have another satyr who's bringing some kind of water to dull the pain. But then she points out that Marcias here is really happy. You can't see it. I don't think you can get the detail. But there's a look of ecstasy on her face, his face, and his arms are really flowing. And they're very relaxed.
What about the figure in the lower left?
Here?
Yeah, that woman.
I don't see it.
Another woman.
Here?
Yeah.
That's Apollo.
Yeah.
He's skinny. Yeah. But it's certainly, you know, you hear Michelangelo referred to the agony and the ecstasy. Well, there is an agony to be an artistic person, see? And he really wasn't, as far as anybody's ever said, he wasn't that kind of a happy person. See? Oh, yeah.
Oh,
see how powerful that is? Yeah. But by putting himself in that depicting himself that way, you can see what it represents his suffering. See? Mm-hmm. Here's another image of Michelangelo, and this is in the Medici tomb. And here, this is his face, and here he is below. Lorenzo, see, the Magnificent, who is one of his patrons, one of his mothers. This shot there sort of represents beautifully where he placed himself on the tomb. See. Here's the final one. This is the conversion of St. Paul. This is in the Pauline Chapel. And this is St. Paul here. And this would be like, you know the story, St. Paul was a Jew who didn't like Christians, he was being mean to them, and he was going to Damascus on his horse, and he had this vision of Jesus who said, what do you think you're doing, why are you doing this, and he gets knocked off his horse. So, in a sense, it's getting knocked off your high horse. Hmm? And I think this was toward the later part of Michelangelo's life. And he was beginning to realize that he was on a high horse, and his attitude toward his work was changing. Hmm? This is one of his sonnets. So now it's over, my day's long voyage through tumultuous ocean in a hull unsteady. I've come to the world's last anchorage and make ready life's log with its every reckoning, foul and fair. The daft illusion once so cuddled there that art was a sovereign lord to idolize, I've come to know how well is a pack of lies. Such as to their grief men treasure yet as true, fond, foolish, and lovesick longings felt before, what becomes of them my double death approaching. One certain shore, one muttering harsh alarms, painting and sculpture soothe the soul no more, its focus fixed on the love divine outstretching on the cross to enfold us closer, open arms. So he was off his high horse. And remember, he was the guy who was making fun of other.
I get that, but also in many, many ways, Michelangelo is immortal.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So that's pretty.
Right.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, I don't know if you've ever heard of St. Thomas Aquinas, but he was a medieval Christian Catholic theologian who wrote the greatest Summa Theologia. And at the end of his life, he said, everything I wrote was meaningless. So even if you're Michelangelo, at the end you would, you know.
Yeah.
What's
And Thomas Aquinas had supposedly the Aurora Consurgence,
right,
the vision of the feminine.
Right.
Very,
yeah.
Very
interesting.
Yeah. I couldn't hear that. That Thomas Aquinas also broke down and had visions and of the Aurora Consurgence, the feminine, the eternal feminine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did I just understand that last sonnet you read that in the end he said that, or you're saying that art, what man produced, was nothing but that he was going to the higher spirit,
yes, yeah.
God, back to God?
Yeah.
Whatever the word is,
yeah.
God himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. So in his life, in our life, our younger life, art was bringing him closer to God, or he may have felt God-like.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in the end,
well, in the end, it's...
Really,
well, in the end, you don't know God.
Excuse us, would you mind repeating what she's saying? We're having a hard time. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to know in a deeper way your understanding of his transition, where I thought, in a way, art was the... all the things he said earlier about art, and I'm thinking
mm-hmm.
more, but art, I thought, brought human beings closer to God, but then it was the hubris, you know,
right,
being God, or so great, and at the end, falling off. But I'm asking, because I don't, in depth, did it mean in the end he rediscovered, reconnected to God?
I think
he
what he realized was that God was beyond his creativity, beyond whatever representation he could create of God.
Uh-huh.
It was beyond that.
Oh.
See?
That's important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I was thinking he was reconnected, but he's actually saying that's a different statement.
Right.
Beyond anything that he could create.
Right, right. And basically, what he wanted, what he needed, was just to be embraced by these arms, see, which was God, but wasn't something he painted on the Sistine Chapel, see.
Well, now that's a paradox. So if he wants to be embraced by these arms.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could be, we would express that according to our own character and our own sort of unique personality, and it could, we could, you know, we could also connect this to wanting to be embraced by mother. See, you know, the God image or the epitome of my experience of God would be my being embraced. See?
Yes.
See?
Yes.
Yeah. But not, this isn't enough. See? See? You know, the creation of Adam and the Sistine Chapel, that wasn't enough. It was beautiful, but that's not it. See?
See?
Here's another.
Did he make it to it?
Yeah. We're all going to make it.
But,
yeah. We're going to do it.
Like, you know, Rothko.
Right.
Suicide. He didn't.
Well, that was a quick.
You know, but I'm just saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Is it
here, I'll give you. Let me read this to you. This is John Doyle. He talks about this. And this is ahead of the last. We've got one more chapter in this. But this is explain might explain it better or confuse you.
Okay.
For Jung, the evolution of religious consciousness is always toward the individual, but to an individual who lives, like the mystics, out of the energies of the ever-present originating maternal nothingness. Such an individual may be a solitary individual, but solitude is rooted in the source of the totality. The rootedness is all important. Its access through institution or individual quest or combinations of both is secondary and is authentic only when it accesses, when the access serves rootedness. Jung could give no better summary of the spirituality informing his psychology than when he writes of the fully conscious religion of the modern. Indeed, he is completely modern only when he comes to the very edge of the world, leaving behind him all that has been discarded and outgrown, and acknowledging that he stands before the nothing out of which all may grow. This is a stark but richly rewarding spirituality, and one which the mystics of the maternal nothingness would recognize as their own. They would join in the applause for the continuity and formulation Jung gave to their experience for his contemporaries and for us. See? So basically, the nothingness is that it's just not something that our concepts can contain. See, but it's a maternal nothingness. It's that 900-year-old prophetess. See, and it's that beautiful girl under God's arms with the small breasts. See, mm-hmm. See, it's the eternal feminine. It's where we started. You know, the first clothes we wore were our mother's womb. See? So we, that. Okay. John Dorley.
What book?
It's not a book. It's a paper he did.
There are a couple books by John Dorley.
Yeah, he's very, very good. Yeah. If you want a copy of that, give me your address. Okay? Okay, this is the final chapter. And I have just two short things to say about this. Is it 8:30?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not too bad, are we?
Uh-huh.
No. Okay. Here we are. This is the third Pieta, and he was working on this when he died. And out of the same marble, this is the third copy. He whittled it away. See, there's a remnant there. See, it was bigger. See, and he's whittled away at it, and it's, you can see the bodies merging. It's sort of like the image on Rembrandt, the body and the cloth are merging. This is, almost looks like a fabric. See, they're becoming one, and I want to mention something. One thing. Uh,
is this piece unfinished? It looks unfinished.
It's finished. That's it.
Oh, really?
That was his final.
He was done.
His final statement. He died 3 days later. Yeah.
So he might have done more on it if he had
time. Well, he tried to destroy it. Right, right. And he tried to destroy the second one too. But here, I want to talk about this. Make a comment about this verse as art. And as art, as in life, you have a reduction, reductio, and you have a recurso, back to the origin, back to the primary, and you also have distortion. Even our own bodies, as we get older, get distorted. You know, if you look, I'm 75. I look at my high school graduation picture. What the hell happened to me? You know, I'm distorted. My nose is different. I mean, you would never believe it was me. See, and we shrink, and our noses get funny, and our ears, and so it's not just an art thing. But in there's a whole movement in art that you're very familiar with, which is called Impressionism, where they just show you the simple, basic facts of what they saw. See, and I just want to elaborate a little bit on that to give you a sense of this as sort of an impressionist piece of work, which is, of course, way before the period of Impressionism. This is a statement by Baudelaire. Art is a synthesis of reality rather than an imitation of objects. Art consists in childlike generalizations and stylizations of minds that see things in their broadest and most relational aspects. The story comes to mind of Picasso, who was visiting a group of children who were drawing, taking drawing lessons. And he told them, he says, I worked for 40 years to learn how Rembrandt paints. And now what I really want to know is how you do it. Subjective distortion. This is Morris Dennis. The result of the artist having recreated the world according to his own personal feelings about the vision of things, his spontaneous and sincerely rendered essential qualities of phenomena without concern for either superficial realism or for conventional preconceived notions of beauty. And we get the freedom to do that. Even if you're not an artist, when you get older, you don't care, you know. Like I remember, I used to go and visit my mother in the nursing home. And my mother was a very nice Yankee lady, you know, a real lady. But she started saying what she meant all the time. In times when it was embarrassing, you know. This is the only way by which an artist can manifest his intuitive, penetrating spiritual vision. So this, you could say, in the context of Impressionism, is Michelangelo's intuitive, penetrating spiritual vision about what his life was. See? Mm-hmm. And it's returning to the matrix. For Van Gogh, he makes a statement. My great longing is to make those incorrectnesses, these deviations, these remodelings, changes in reality, so that they become, yes, lies if you like, but truer than the literal truth. So that's what I just wanted to say as far as the artistic merit of this. And now I want to talk about alchemy. Sorry. Here it is. I forgot. I want to show you these. This is Van Gogh's Pieta. This is Gauguin. I love this. I absolutely love this. Look at this here. And look at that. And he does this. This is like juxtaposing the archetypal lamentation with this woman's lamentation. She's a worker, see? She's got a basket, she's got a flag, she's tired, she's going home from work. See, they're coming home from work. See? He does the same thing with the nativity scene, where he has, it's the same setting, and this is a nativity scene, and in front of it, there's an ox cart going home from work. And it's Christmas Eve. They're going to go home and they're going to go to midnight mass. See? But the nativity is subdued. It's moved way back. And you see these hardworking people with the ox, with their ox cart, you know. And then you flash to see the ox and the nativity scene. See? Very, very beautiful. Here's Chagall. Picasso. Guernica. Now this is an example of reductio. In one of the previous editions of this third Pieta, you have, this is Mary's face, see? Now she's been stripped down and now this is Mary's face. You see it? See? So I want to just read this one final thing, and then we've got one final little show. Mm-hmm. This setting refers to the mortificatio or purificatio stage of the individuation process. And that's the dying stage. Hmm? But the king's return to the womb is the same, both a death and a conception of fertilization. So this merging of the mother and the son, the king and the queen, is at the same time a death and a conception of fertilization. The dissolution of the old king, he's digested, so to speak, in the body of the mother, is simultaneously the gestation of the new king. It's something like what happens with the formation of a chrysalis, of a caterpillar, when he undergoes dissolution and is reconstructed as a butterfly. The idea of sowing seed that dies and then rejuvenates in another form is basic image in alchemy. One major analogy is the passage in John's Gospel that says, "Truly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. He who loves his life loses it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life." So this your now here's some alchemical stuff. This is the image in alchemy that I'm posing against this third Pieta. It's the king and queen, the mother and the son, in the dying. See? It's Jung uses these images in his work on the transference. Here's the birth of the child out of the death. Hmm? Now, if we were just talking about analysis, this is what happens in analysis. This is what happens in life. when you let go of some major defining idea, thought, attitude, and you allow it to die. Hmm? If it dies, then you get the new thing. And we go through this all the time. You know, you don't have to do analysis for this, but it helps sometimes. And here's another image of it. Here we've got another quaternity. See? You've got Adam and the mother. See the tree? And there's the mother. And in this death, gives birth to the soul. See? Isn't that beautiful? Isn't she gorgeous? She's full. She's. See?
Who's on the right?
That's God, the Father. That's the Father. So you have the quaternity, the mother and the father and the husband and the wife. See?
Who's the artist?
Michelangelo. Yeah. That's the creation of Eve. Hmm? But it's strikingly powerful when you look at it in the context of the alchemical image. See? And you notice this image, the face here, is very similar to the face on the Roman Pietà. Hmm? Can you dim the lights?
Sure. But he's dying, you're saying?
Hmm?
Adam.
Well, he's asleep. But he's dead. Hmm?
Okay.
I'm talking symbolically. Yeah. See, he's, he, when he dies, then the soul. So he's giving up something. He's giving up his rib, but he's giving up something that is singular, something, some kind of isolation, some kind of exclusivity, you know? Yeah. Like that happens to men, and that happens to women. See? This is the final show.
He thought he had it made.
Yeah. But didn't.
Yeah.
It gets worse.
Yeah. Yeah, lots worse.
Right. Sorry, what happened? Yep. What did I do?
Yep.
Can you? I pressed the closing volume. That's that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Good. There it is. Yeah. Okay. There it is. Lights. Sorry. That's all, folks.
When did he draw that?
That was a drawing of the resurrection. The sketch. And that was, I don't know, do you know when he did that?
Well, we presumed that it was going to be a fresco above the Virgin in the Medici Tillers.
Midlife. But that was, I thought that was the first game. Resurrection. Mm-hmm.
Didn't Michelangelo also do the Prisoners of Stone in the Academia?
He did, I think, yes.
That was toward the end of his life, and the David in the same museum was at the beginning of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so at the beginning of his life, you have sort of perfection.
Yeah.
At the end of his life, you have this sort of feeling that life is really about struggling to free yourself from the stone.
Yeah. In the the Julius tomb, some of the pieces he worked on but didn't finish were a group of slaves. I think there were six. Were there six slaves?
Yes.
But the ones that you're talking about in the Academia were the unfinished works that were going to be for the facade of San Lorenzo, which was that project never took off because of the political changes and so on at that time.
So they were truly unfinished, or was it meant to be?
No,
they were meant to be prisoners.
Well, they were meant to be prisoners, but they were unfinished. They just stopped the project. They ran out of money. The whole political structure of Florence fell apart, so they didn't use them for the facade of San Lorenzo.
But still, it reminds me of the third Pietà, which there's an aspect of it which is not quite having emerged from the stone.
Right. Or he's merging back into the stone.
Yeah. Or the Christ is merging back into the Virgin.
Right.
And they're becoming one.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where is that third Pietà?
It's in Milan.
In Milan?
Yeah. Yeah. The second one is in Florence. And that one's in Milan.
Yeah. I'm curious about the mother's. All the imagery related to the mother, but also his stepmother lived until
he was 22. Right.
And is there any mention in the historical record of their relationship and how she might have influenced him?
I don't know.
I thought it was really interesting what you shared about his early childhood,
mm-hmm.
that he was sent away until he was two to be nursed by another mother.
Right.
When he came back to his own mother,
mm-hmm.
she shortly died, who knows how involved she was with him. And I noticed that in almost every painting, the arms were extra long.
Right.
The
mm-hmm.
pictures,
yeah.
And in some of the sculptures too. And when you read that, I believe it was the sonnet, ending with that he wants to
right.
come back
yeah.
in his arms.
Right, yeah, too. Yeah, yeah. That's very good observation. Like he wanted to reach out, or he wanted to be reached out to.
He was longing
yeah.
for that.
Yeah.
Which in the third Pietà he had.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There she is, she's holding.
Yeah.
Her arms are there.
Yes? Yep.
I couldn't help but notice that the position of the Christ figure changed from vertical to horizontal.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, from horizontal to vertical.
Right, yeah.
That's an interesting progression.
It is. How would you understand that? Any thoughts about what that might suggest?
Only that in the Pietà, the Roman Pietà, body, it really looks like a dead
body. Right. Yeah.
And the others.
Yeah.
You can't be sure.
Right.
Isn't some
yeah.
kind of
yeah.
Related.
A lot of scholars mention it. You know, is he rising? Is there?
In the third Pietà, yeah,
mm-hmm.
the Christ figure really looks slender and far more like a woman.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, that hyper masculinity is gone.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a part of it is maybe that some of his earlier figures are male, bulky. They're buff. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple that would be a good. You're noticing that. I mean, he's over the buff period,
yep.
or he's over like watching the. Imitating the Greek powerful male.
Yeah.
And there's another one here like that, I'll show you. Sorry, put you through this.
this. This is a wooden carving he did, and some of the commenters say that this is also not the buff male. You know, this is a fragile young man. See.
When was this done?
That was early. I think that was very early. Yeah. I don't know. He tried to destroy both the second and the third. Frustration, or maybe feeling he was dying, or feeling that he had failed, or he couldn't bring this to fruition. You know.
Sort of goes along with what he wrote at the end there.
Right.
It wasn't giving him that connection that
right.
he was craving.
Right. Yeah.
What you were saying about Aquinas and the end of the theater, some theologically, it's
right.
nothing.
Yeah.
The first Pieta is a young buck flashing his sculptural chops.
Right.
It's a decorative quality.
Right.
And that's completely gone.
Yeah.
And it also becomes much more integrated because the drapery just. See, it's almost pulling you off.
Right.
Appreciating the feeling.
Yeah. I mean, it's what we do at 23. I mean, I was very devout at 23. Good. I think are we all set? Yeah. One more.
This is not exactly on this.
Go ahead.
Earlier in your lecture, you said this interesting phrase. It was. Passion of the defeat. I thought that phrase really struck me.
I don't.
Passionate defeat.
Mm-hmm.
Was that in the Greek drama?
Yes, it was in the Greek drama. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just thought, wow, what is that?
Well, to be defeated is passionate. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it depends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not passive. It would be, I think, to be defeated would be, could use that word. Hmm?
Thank you.
Sorry.
Where's the pietà that's possibly South American with a palm tree that you have the contemporary?
Oh, that's I try to include all kinds of things. Sculpture is from the Whitney plantation of Afro-American history, and that's a black angel with a deceased baby. Thank you for inviting me.